Shrink Wrap Radio number 388, William James as Progenitor of Transpersonal Psychology, with Dr. Mark B. Ryan.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Professor Mark B. Ryan about the contributions of America's first psychologist, William James. Dr. Ryan is a graduate of Yale and has taught at other universities. He's Associate Dean of the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies of Ubiquity University. You'll find more detail on his background in our show notes. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Mark Ryan, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, Dave, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah, well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show. For some time, I thought I should interview someone about William James, and I mentioned it on air, and listener Jimmy Pryor wrote to say that he had heard you give an excellent presentation on James, so I'm really glad that you...
Yes, I know Jimmy. Mm-hmm.
You do? Yeah, I think you told me that was a presentation you gave at the Houston Jung Society, is that right?
That's right. It's called the C.G. Jung Educational Center of Houston. Very lively organization, I might add. Some really interesting folks.
Yeah, I'm aware of that because I think I've interviewed a bunch of them.
Aha. Mm-hmm. it's a very worthy organization.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how did you, let's jump into it. You wrote a very intriguing article about William James, and our interview is mostly going to be based on that article, although you can feel free to throw in any other relevant information. How did you first become interested in William James yourself?
Well, this goes back at least to my graduate school, if not college days. I ended up writing a master's thesis on James back in the late 1960s. I've always found him a fascinating figure for a number of reasons. He's just addresses core concerns that I think many of us have subconsciously, if not consciously, through our lives. But he does it in a way that feels to me rather unique. You know, he came from his educational background was intriguing. He grew up as the son of a significant philosopher in his own day, Henry James Sr. Remarkable family. He's the brother of Henry James, the novelist. They had a sister, Alice, who was also a remarkable intellectual figure, diarist in her own right. And the family was prominent, had visitors such as Ralph Waldo Emerson around the dinner table. Emerson was actually a friend of Henry James Sr., William's father. And the father also led quite a peripatetic life. So James's education was rather unique. He never went through school systems until his college days. He was tutored by a series of very knowledgeable figures, studied in France, Germany, and England as a child, also Switzerland, became fluent in French and German, also spoke Italian and Portuguese.
Wow.
So he had a very varied and I think stimulating form of education himself. And then he was of a temperament that has always appealed to me because he has such range, really an incredible range. He trained early on as an artist, studied with William Morris Hunt, a major American painter of the time, alongside John Lafarge, who became also one of the major artists in the States in his epoch, but then veered towards the sciences. So he had this artistic temperament, yet a real interest in a strongly developed rational since, studied chemistry, physics, geology before he went into anatomy and then medicine. And he had besides the side that was rational and empirical, and he also had quite a mystical side to him. He wouldn't have called himself a mystic, but he certainly had a religious sensibility as well as an artistic one. So we have a range in there that I think is just a lot of people don't really capture. And that drove him towards a way of thinking that I like.
Well, let me jump in here before you go too much further. I really identify with him. You know, I kind of also myself have felt like I've got one foot in the world of science and another foot in the world of humanities and maybe even, I don't know if I'd say mysticism. So I can understand why you related to him so strongly, because I kind of get the sense that you and I have a fair amount in common as well. And I never read James, but I'm always encountering quotes of things that he's written, you know, a paragraph here, people will head a chapter with a quote from James, and they always seem so contemporary. And so that, you know, I've felt like it's a great hole in my own background not to know more about him. And so, as I mentioned, you've written this very fine paper on James and his relationship to what eventually became transpersonal psychology. And your paper was published in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. And I want my listeners to know that I'll be putting a link to it in the show notes that will accompany this podcast interview. So I really appreciate the family background that you gave us and a sense of the milieu. And his father was also a follower of Emanuel Swedenborg, who's another interesting guy in his own right.
Yes, quite a mystical figure. And I think it was a tension in William James's life, especially early on, because he came into maturity just as the intellectual world was getting supremely excited about the natural sciences and just after Darwin. So mm-hmm. It was a time when universities were establishing the scientific schools, and the prestige of the natural sciences was rising to an unprecedented level. And so James never fully identified with his father's way of thinking. He, I think, somewhat in rebellion to his father, went into this study of chemistry and physics and anatomy. And geology, he accompanied Louis Agassiz on a geological exposition to the Amazon. So there was a tension there, but he always had those religious yearnings that were so deep in his father as well. And I think he went through something of a personal crisis in his late 20s, just in time for his first Saturn return, if you know anything about the astrology. But he really went into a depression, and it was then, I think, that he really connected with this religious side and formed a genuine religious sensibility of his own.
That's what was the depression about? Do we have any idea of what the content of that depression was?
Well, it had, I'm sure, a personal side. His cousin, whom he was very close to, a young woman named Minnie Temple, had died, and there were some personal issues, no doubt. But he also thought of it in intellectual terms. So he really was oppressed by the rising materialism that he was being convinced of in his own mind, it was a kind of materialistic way of thinking that was associated with the rising science in his day, in which really everything was seen as utterly determined, and there was no place for free will, determined by material, chemical, and physical causes, all of life, and all each of our thoughts and behaviors. And he found that quite oppressive, and he
Well, I think many of us have struggled with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was that he made a comment then that if he made it much later, and it was only after he made it that people identified the fact that he was talking about himself, but it's passages in his great work, The Varieties of Religious Experience, in which he said that if I hadn't clung to scriptural text, that I might have gone, I think I would have gone really insane. The texts like the ones he mentioned where the eternal God is my refuge, I am the resurrection and the life, but he wasn't taking that in a strictly Christian way, even though those are biblical texts. His family was not conventionally religious, nor was he ever in his life. But he needed to believe and to accept that there was another dimension, that there was a larger reality than the strictly material world that we can observe.
Yes, you mentioned that he was strongly influenced by the American Transcendentalist. And that kind of led to kind of a broader sense of spirituality?
Well, I think he was both influenced and somewhat in rebellion, because he was the Transcendentalists, of course, were philosophers. They were not, for the most part, empirical scientists, although we have very careful observation in people like Thoreau, for example. But he certainly, that was part of the milieu that he had absorbed in his childhood with particularly with Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Am I correct that James was initially a philosopher and only later became a psychologist?
Well, no, actually, he although that's some. It was really the other way around. He went into medical school. This was at a time when there was really no distinction in the academic world between psychology and philosophy. Mm-hmm. What psychology was done was usually done under the aegis of philosophy departments. And his initial appointment was in anatomy and physiology, but then he became interested in psychology, and his first great work was Principles of Psychology, published in 1890. And that one could argue that work, it was a major two-volume, very comprehensive survey of psychological knowledge at the time, really solidified the field as an empirical enterprise. It really helped make it a science. He himself said that his purpose in the book was to try to make a science out of psychology by treating it as one. So that work is quite physical in orientation. It's always looking for physical components to associate with psychological functions, and it tried to look at the psyche as something different than the traditional way of thinking of a soul, for example. So in that sense, he was launched into the intellectual world as a psychologist, and later took more of a turn towards philosophy, and was always interested in the very deepest questions of that psychology might raise. And after all, psychology is a study of human nature, and his he never abandoned really a quest to know what can we know and how can we call it true? Those really deepest questions that are raised in both epistemology and psychology.
Yes. So as a philosopher, his stance was something you characterize as radical empiricism. And I believe he's also credited as creating the first psychological laboratory in the U.S., which was at Harvard.
That's right. This was a time when experimental psychology was just getting going. There may be a rival claim to that, but many people really feel that his was the first. Whether it was there are some other claims, but I think that's true.
And let's see, we talked about his psychological crisis, and you write that James was a seeker, that he sought out and studied non-ordinary states. He experimented with what we would call alternative medicine, from homeopathy to hypnotism, mm-hmm. and to mind cure. I assume by mind cure you mean sort of mind over matter kind of thing, maybe as a Christian Science.
Exactly. This was, Christian Science begins in Boston, and it was a time when it was on the rise, and he was very concerned, very impressed, really, with the results that the kinds of healing that could happen outside of the medical establishment.
And you also write that his curiosity about the potential of the psyche prompted him to experiment occasionally with hallucinogenic substances. Say a bit more about that, if you will.
Well, there was a rather eccentric upstate New York writer by the name of Benjamin Paul Blood, who had a mystical experience in the dentist chair with nitrous oxide, which was used as an anesthetic. And Blood wrote something called The Anesthetic Revelation, based on his experiences with nitrous oxide particularly. And it fascinated James enough to try it. And it really had a profound effect on him, because he understood in a way that he hadn't before what we mean when we use the term nowadays of a non-ordinary state of consciousness. He could see that the world of consciousness that we operate in was really a very limited one, and that there were many other possible ways for consciousness to take form.
So in a way, he's kind of a predecessor of the whole 1960s psychedelic experiment or discovery that really that opened so many people up to the idea that, well, there might be more going on than meets the eye.
Yes, and he came to that. He was certainly not a frequent user of drugs, but he came to a very fundamental understanding with his own experience with nitrous oxide. But another phenomenon that captivated him really through much of his life, utterly dismissed in the scientific circles and unexplained by materialism, was the phenomenon of spiritualism. This was a time when that was quite popular in the popular culture, of mediums apparently making contact with the dead, or at least going into a kind of trance state and channeling something and feeling that that's what they were doing. And he saw that there was no way that the dominant materialistic outlook could explain that. And he could explain some of the resulting phenomena. He came to it, he got involved in 1883 when traveling in England with a group called the Society for Psychical Research, which was interested in these phenomena, but interested in exploring them in as scientific a way as possible at the time, really really investigating and putting controls on these mediumistic figures and the results of that they were having in trance sessions. And they were also working with hypnotism. He himself did quite a bit of experimentation on Harvard students, I might add, with hypnosis. And he shortly after getting linked up with the Society for Psychical Research, he met a particular medium by the name of Leonore Piper, who was active in Boston. And he was actually dragged to a visit with her by his mother-in-law, and went with a skeptical attitude. But she was able to somehow know things about relationships in the James family that she had no way of knowing in her ordinary state of mind. She would go into trance states. And he saw repeated examples of this, and then began to really study her in earnest, and promoted others studying her, others from including in Britain with the who were part of that society.
So they attempted to do scientific controls and so on to make sure that it wasn't deception of some sort?
Absolutely. They would keep her isolated from the people she was going to interview or to meet with. They would make sure that she was not meeting with other people. They would at given times, they would even had her, I think, you know, with her own. She was very much part of these experiments, but she would be, by her voluntary agreement, confined when she visited in England, so as to not raise any possibility that she might have had contact with some of the people who would attend her séance, that sort of thing. And so the society, tried to walk a kind of middle path in these studies. On the one hand, they didn't just accept that the explanation was necessarily the visitation of the spirit of a dead person, as the spiritualist immediately thought of it. They were looking for more psychological explanations, but it drove them towards a point of view in which the psyche was much more than it was conventionally thought of in the popular culture, and certainly than it was thought of in academic circles. So it had he was walking the line between the spiritualist on the one hand and the strict materialist on the other, who simply dismissed these phenomena as impossible and really wouldn't engage, often wouldn't even engage in the experiments because they just thought it was nonsense, or they were threatened enough by it that they didn't want to let that into their worldview, so to speak.
Well, I think his position that I assume he was considering that the information might be coming telepathically somehow, or as you say, part of a broader sense of consciousness than we normally conceive of, that actually is probably would fit quite well with contemporary parapsychologists who theorize about these things.
Well, it's interesting, Dave, you mentioned the word telepathically. That the word telepathy was coined by James's colleague in the Society for Psychical Research, the SPR, we refer to it as. It was Frederick Myers was his name, and he can really be credited vastly unknown figure. He was much more important than probably not a name that many of our listeners know, but he really came up with the first comprehensive theory of the subconscious mind in the early 1890s. And he telepathy was one way they were explaining this. For example, it could be a person in the room telepathically communicating with the medium. But sometimes they would come up with facts that the person in the room wasn't conscious of, but that could later be verified. So then maybe the theory became it's a telepathic communication, not from one conscious mind to another, but from a subconscious mind to another subconscious. And eventually James, this pushed James towards a notion, Myers as well actually, of a collective unconscious. Well before Carl Jung investigated that phenomenon. And James eventually wrote about what he conceived of as a kind of mother sea of consciousness where all our memories exist in some way.
Now, so, James would have been older than Jung, right?
Yes.
And yes. Is there a chance that Jung was influenced by James's thought or writing in his developing his ideas about a kind of universal consciousness?
On that specific topic, I'm not sure, but he was certainly aware of James. The two of them actually met once in 1909 at the Clark University Conference. That was the conference that lured Sigmund Freud to the United States for his only visit. It was called by a man named G. Stanley Hall, who had been a student of James, to celebrate the 20th anniversary, I believe it was, of the beginnings of Clark University, which was at the time seen as a major graduate school with great ambitions. But at that conference, they met. And it's interesting that Jung wrote a letter, which still exists, describing his meeting. He was very impressed by James, especially by his openness. And the two of them had, I think, two lengthy discussions. I believe there were dinner discussions on two evenings in which they were talking about some of these more spiritual elements of the psyche. But that was not the tenor of the conference at all. That certainly wasn't the tenor of Sigmund Freud's work. So they had a connection around that notion. And in fact, Jung's doctoral dissertation was about a medium. She happened to be his cousin, Helen Pricework is her name. And he was quite interested in these phenomena himself.
Oh, they must have had a marvelous conversation. I can imagine them getting on famously.
I think so, but Jung also observed that James at that point wasn't taken so seriously at the conference, precisely because of his interest in these phenomena in his work with Leodore Piper. This is despite the fact that by that time he was so famous, particularly for Principles of Psychology and for the Varieties of Religious Experience, which was published about 7 years before that conference.
Fascinating. Do we know whether Jung and James had correspondence after that?
I don't think there's correspondence between them that I'm aware of, but they both mentioned the meetings they had to others.
Okay, well, I would think that Jung You know, from what you've said, it just seems like such a strong hypothesis that Jung would have read James after that meeting and would have been influenced to some degree.
Well, it is quite possible for this reason. Most of James' writing in this vein remained rather obscure. Some of it is included in the Varieties of Religious Experience, but that's a more mainstream work. For the group, the Society for Psychical Research, he was publishing in their in-house journal, the journal from the society. So that was not widely read. However, it was read by people who were interested in these phenomena. Also, Jung and James had a link through a man named Theodore Flournoy, a Frenchman who was very interested in these phenomena and wrote a book on his own investigations of mediums. The title of his most best-known book in that vein was called From India to the Planet Mars, about somebody who felt that she was could enter the consciousness of someone in India and a Martian. So some of these things we cannot take fully literally. But Flournoy was a teacher of Jung and also a very good friend and collaborator with James.
Interesting. And of course, Jung is well known for reading far and wide and reading things that, you know, that you would really have to dig for.
Yeah, one aspect of this that I'd like to know more about, if there's any evidence for it, is how much Jung knew about the psychological model that James was entertaining at the time. It was a model really created by Frederick Myers, but Myers made the analogy of a spectrum of consciousness, about consciousness being analogous to the spectrum of light, which was just being investigated in those years. And just as light is visible only in a very narrow range along the possible spectrum of light waves, Myers suggested that our ordinary waking consciousness was really just a narrow range of our potential consciousness. And there's an interesting distinction here between this model and Freud, for example, because Freud's notion of the subconscious was, as you probably know better than I, has to do with repressed traumas and trivia, things that never make it to the level of consciousness because they have such a small impact in our lives. And it was also the source of neuroses. But James and Myers were looking at a model in which all of that included all of that, but also saw the subconscious as the source of supernormal knowledge, of greater capacities, of the kinds of insights, the clairvoyance that could be shown by mediums or telepathy as another element in it, and genius. You know, we tend to think of genius as hyper-development of the rational mind, but for them, genius indicated a permeable boundary between the conscious mind and all that we might be putting together about in our unconscious minds, so that we really had a capacity much greater than we normally suppose and normally exhibit. And this, for Myers and to a major degree for James as well, leads up to the capacity to have mystical experiences and really greater insights than the norm. Into the nature of ultimate reality.
And that model also certainly fits very well with Jung, but also seems to anticipate Ken Wilber. Didn't he write about a spectrum of consciousness?
He certainly did. That's he uses that term, but it's quite interesting to me that Myers was drawing such an analogy 70 years before Ken Wilber, although Ken Wilber develops it in other sorts of ways.
Yeah, it's always mind-blowing when we go back and read the original text of some of these historical figures, and it's always kind of mind-blowing to discover that, hey, they were really smart, and they were onto a whole lot that we think that we've discovered or invented.
Well, and there's such an example of that in transpersonal psychology. As you know, that term gets employed in 1968 or thereabouts, and is usually transpersonal psychology is usually traced to Abraham Maslow in his work on peak experiences and fully developed humans in the late 60s, or to the work with psychedelics done by Stanislav Grof and others. But so many of the what they originally thought they were discovering for the first time, we can find in some of these earlier psychologists like James and Myers and Jung. They did recognize that they had forebears. Willis Harmon wrote about, referred to at least as forebears, R.M. Buck, who wrote Cosmic Consciousness, and Harmon at least was aware of Myers's major work, which was called Human Personality and the Survival of Bodily Death, and The Varieties of Religious Experience was another one he referred to. But I really think that a lot of the philosophical underpinnings of transpersonal psychology were elaborated in enduring prose, really, by William James a full half century or more earlier.
Yes. And speaking of Maslow, by the way, you write that James had had a couple of what Maslow would call peak experiences while in nature. What do we know about those? And I assume those probably became a lot earlier, came for him a lot earlier than some of the stuff that we've just now been talking about.
Well, I'm not sure it was earlier. James actually initiates in The Varieties of Religious Experience the modern discussion of mysticism. Before he used the term in that book, it was seldom used as a noun. The term mystical was around, and he didn't coin the term mysticism, but it was mystical experience was usually examined within the confines of a particular religious tradition. And with that term, what James was doing was at least giving currency to the notion that this is something that's cross-cultural, that penetrates many different religious traditions. And he himself didn't think of himself as leaning strongly in that direction. He wasn't prone to mysticism. He thought of himself as quite a rational sort of person. However, he did have two ways in which he had what I think we can fairly call some level of mystical experience. One of them was through the nitrous oxide, as we mentioned, and the other was through experiences in nature. He was an inveterate hiker. He walked a lot. And he refers in his letters to two different experiences, one in the Adirondacks and another in the Swiss Alps, in which he seemed to have a very strong sense of I think, oneness with nature and beyond nature.
Okay, so before you mentioned that there seemed to be some impact on his reputation from his willingness to explore psychical phenomena, what was the impact on his professional reputation as a scientist, and at what point in his life did that become an issue?
Well, it was in those later years when he kept studying people like Leonora Piper and working with the Society for Psychical Research. You know, psychology in those days was taking a very materialistic turn as it was trying to establish itself as a legitimate science. And that was, as I understand it, one of the reasons Freud didn't want to talk much about these phenomena was because he was afraid that it would work against the establishment of psychoanalysis as a scientific enterprise. And so psychologists, that was a time when behaviorism and became a major force, as well as psychoanalysis. But if you look at the long history of psychology, I think if you go back prior to behaviorism and prior to psychoanalysis, we find quite a vibrant, in the late 19th century, a vibrant schools of psychology that very much made room for spirit, for some kind of spiritual experience. And that fell out of favor in the early 20th century. And so James's was taken less and less serious as a psychologist by many of his colleagues, until we have the rise of transpersonal psychology in the 60s. And then I think like to think that article helps and point the way towards a kind of resurrection of James's work in this vein. And by the way, I can't talk about these things without paying homage to the work of Eugene Taylor, who did a great deal to unearth this side of James and bring it to public attention with a couple of books published in the 1980s or thereabouts.
When did your article appear, by the way? I didn't see a date on the copy that I read.
Let's see, what are we, sometime around 2008, I guess, 2009 perhaps, I can't tell you offhand.
Okay, reasonably recent. You know, I want to go back to something you were saying about there was a time when the early psychologists were perhaps more open to the spiritual dimension, and some probably, you know, were closet. They were in the closet because you mentioned Fechner. Now, I remember Fechner, you know, when I was studying the history of psychology as a graduate student. He was an important name. I'm trying to remember for what. Maybe it was psychophysics. And you said that, tell us a little bit about Fechner and his other side.
James was fascinated by Fechner. And I think they both had some distinct religious experiences at a given point, and that helped them with depressions. But Fechner, it goes back quite a bit earlier. He did work in the 1830s and 40s, and he became best remembered in psychology because of very empirical physical investigations and the establishment of the field of psychophysics. But it comes as a surprise to many people who know something of his name and associated with that to look into the side that James became more and more intrigued with as his own life went along. Fechner wrote a book in the 1830s called The Little Book of Life After Death, I think it was. And James, some 40 or 50 years later, wrote an introduction to a version of that. There was a translation of that published in English. And then he, in in one of his last works, Pluralistic Philosophy, James explores Fechner in detail in chapters in that work. And what he's especially interested in is Fechner's panpsychism, in which Fechner has this idea that consciousness really is part of all of reality, that many aspects of reality have not only a physical manifestation, but a conscious side as well. And he would trace that down to smallest items in physical nature and into the earth. So Fechner believed in a kind of Gaia. He didn't use that term, but it was an earth consciousness, and saw this consciousness as kind of building up in wider and wider spheres, and this widest sphere he would call God, or at least say that's what people referred to as God. And James took that idea seriously. And eventually he felt that some kind of collective consciousness was as good an explanation as he could come up with of the phenomena he was observing with with mediums and with people in trance states. So he has this beautiful passage, which is inspired by Fechner. He says, "Our lives are like islands in the sea or like trees in the forest. The trees commingle their roots in the darkness underground, and the islands also hang together through the ocean's bottom. Just so there is a continuum of cosmic consciousness against which our individuality builds but accidental fences, and into which our several minds plunge as into a mother sea or reservoir." Wow. So that mother sea for James was a scientific explanation, if you will, because it could give us a better explanation than most of the others he could try about some of these phenomena that he observed.
Now, also, I get the impression that James, to some extent, really anticipated Thomas Kuhn's idea of paradigm revolutions. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, James was he was principally interested, I'd say, in making spiritual experience valid before scientifically oriented minds, and he could see that the way the academic and scientific world was tending towards a strict materialism. And he felt that that was itself a philosophical position, but not a scientific one. That is to say, it was not proven by evidence. It was a leap of faith. So he made this strong distinction between the procedures of science on the one hand and the philosophy of positivism or materialism on the other hand. It was somewhat what he meant by radical material empiricism, because he felt that his empiricism was radical because it didn't exclude empirical observations that the normal science often excluded. So he gives an analysis of the development of science that, yes, I feel really anticipates what Kuhn wrote about half a century later in the 1960s. And that is, if you look at the procedure, it's that you have a kind of ordinary science, a kind of consensus, but there are always facts that can't be explained by the scientific framework or the theory that's at hand. And geniuses will come in, and really look at those extraneous, anomalous theories, and when observations, facts. And when they do, then they end up redefining the scientific consensus. That's when theories really move forward and become more encompassing. So that's an analysis that emphasizes the importance of what James called wild facts, facts that are observed that are simply not accountable in the theory that is the consensus of the moment.
And so he really felt that as time went by, science would evolve and some of the notions that he was setting forth would be accepted, and some kind of empirical ways of substantiating them would come along. Do I have that right?
I think you do, yes. And he also saw, or at least entertained the notion, Myers argued it a little more forcefully, was that our minds are evolving. I mean, the Michael Murphy's work on the future of the body is anticipated here, whereas these capacities, these somewhat supernormal capacities that some individuals show, can reveal the way consciousness might be evolving in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn the spotlight on you now. You are Associate Dean of the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies of Ubiquity University. So that's something that some listeners might be interested in, because when I went to the website, I saw that on the sort of advisory faculty or some other people like Gene Houston and other Stan Groff. So tell us about that institution and your involvement with it.
Well, yes, it has some exciting people teaching with us, Carolyn Mace, Rick Tarnas, and Ralph Metzger, I think, has done some work with the group. This Wisdom School itself is older than what we're calling Ubiquity University. What was known for a while as Wisdom University grew out of the University of Creation Spirituality, founded by Matthew Fox in Berkeley, and it was taken over some 8 or so years ago by the current president of Ubiquity, Jim Garrison, and went under the name of Wisdom University for 7 or so years, and recently has been incorporated into an entity now being established called Ubiquity University, but that is an internet-based university, and it has not yet come online and is not yet offering courses. It's still in formation. It has strong ambitions to have a global reach and really make a difference in educating people across the world. But meanwhile, the real courses that are being offered are through what we now call the Wisdom School of Graduates Study.
And is that online study, or how is that structured?
It's both online and in person. Many of the classes are offered in one-week intensives, so people meet and study a particular item very intensively for a week. And often the place is related to the field of study. I first got acquainted with them by attending a class on medieval mysticism given at the Chartres Cathedral in France, and also went with them to a study of St. Francis that was done in Assisi. And we have people who teach quite a bit about the natural world and spirituality associated with it in the California Redwoods and in Central Texas. Will Tegel is our dean. He's written a book called The Mother Tongue about that really, I would say, draws on, or at least his roots are Native American, but it certainly comports with the notion of a conscious living universe that Fechner articulated and that James was tending towards himself.
This sounds like maybe this is oriented towards people that are already established in their lives and careers rather than people who are just starting out and looking for licensing as therapists or something like that.
Yeah, most of our students are people middle age or beyond, but not all. We also have some young ones as well. The Ubiquity is more of an undergraduate school, or will be. But the Wisdom School itself is licensed by the state of California. It's not accredited according by one of the regional accrediting agencies yet, but it has it does have an appeal primarily to people who are in it for their own edification more than licensure.
Yeah. Okay. And so as we wind down now, I wonder, you know, in relation to James and what we've been talking about, if there's anything you'd like to add by way of summary.
Well, thank you, Dave. Yeah, you know, I'd like to go back to why I find James such a personal inspiration.
Oh, good.
And I think I would tie that to two characteristics of his thought. Well, three, really. One being that he's just a master of English prose. He's one of the great, great prose writers that this nation, I feel, has produced. But beyond that, his way of thinking has such a humility and authenticity about it. And what I mean by that is, by the humility, is that he's very conscious of the limitations of both his own way of thinking and what humanity itself is equipped to grasp. He sometimes used the analogies of a dog in our libraries. We interact with the dogs as we're talking about whatever we may be reading or as we're having political discussions at the dinner table, but the dog presumably has a limited ability to grasp all of what might be in our conversation or in the library that surrounds us. And we humans might be in the same way, might be the same way. So he always kept an open mind and was always willing to recognize that even his own formulations were limited and could be improved upon. And the other aspect of it is that he always insisted that experience be authentic, in the sense that, especially as he's talking about religious experience, he really felt that it was meaningful only if it engaged that whole person and that really believed it. So he was always resistant toward accepting anything simply on the basis of authority. One comment here, which I find quite inspirational. He says, "The wisest of critics is an altering being, subject to the better insight of the morrow, and right at any moment, only up to date and on the whole. When larger ranges of truth open, it is surely best to be able to open ourselves to their reception, unfettered by our previous pretensions." So he honored what each person could bring to the table. And that was the root of a philosophy that he later elaborates called pluralism, where he felt that if each person stays in his own experience and others tolerate him there, that's the way that's best. And it's only when you put all of those voices together that you get something closer to a whole truth. And those are perhaps coming out of a rather dogmatic religious training in my own roots. I've found inspirational through much of my adult intellectual life.
Well, that is a great wrap-up for our interview. Mark B. Ryan, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much, Dave. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Although Dr. Ryan is based in Texas, he let me know that he frequently visits friends in Sebastopol, which is not too far from where I live. So I suggested that the next time he's in the area, we get together for coffee. I think we're more or less the same age and seems like we have a lot in common. One other fact that didn't come up in our interview is that, among other things, he's a senior trainer for Stan Grof's holotropic breathwork seminars. Well, it should be clear that Dr. William James was way ahead of his time in so many respects. It's probably taken until our time for his work to be fully appreciated. I came to the interview with considerable respect for him, but that was based mostly on hearsay and references to him in other readings. Dr. Ryan's article and my conversation with him gave me more basis for admiring William James. If I weren't so busy reading the books written by my guests, I'd take time to read his varieties of religious experience. Maybe when I retire someday, when I really retire. One thing I meant to ask about but lost track of in the interview has to do with his standing versus that of his brother, Henry James, the novelist. As I recall, William James was highly regarded for his writing more than Henry James. I once read something by Henry James, I think it was in college, and as I recall, it wasn't terribly compelling. By the way, I just took a look at the Wikipedia entry on William James, and there's a lot of additional information there about him and his thought. For example, he earned an MD, but never practiced medicine. And he's quoted that the first lecture he ever heard on psychology was one he gave. You gotta love that. As I mentioned in the interview, I've put a link in our show notes to Dr. Ryan's very fine article that appeared in, it turns out, the 2008 Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. It's really worth your taking time to read it if you're at all interested in William James or the conversation you heard here.
Hi, this is Kathy O'Canna calling. I am calling to express my gratitude for all of the effort that you have put into providing weekly thought-provoking podcasts. One of your interviews mentioned that Western medicine provides numerous diagnoses and very little in the way of healing underlying trauma. I am hoping that we are entering into an age where people refuse to treat their symptoms by pharmacological means, whether medically or self-prescribed. Knowing that there is no one approach to healing that will be effective for everyone, I encourage people to listen to your podcasts to help them discover approaches which resonate with them so they can begin their own journey towards healing. While on the couch with Dr. Dave, I have found myself paying greater attention to my dreams, practicing yoga more frequently, shifting my priorities to allow myself time to care for myself, increasing my attempts to remain in the present, renewing my interest in fairy tales, mythology, and the tarot, and mustering the courage to work on my marriage in a more constructive way. I believe that it is easier to stay angry and blame others than to acknowledge our own roles in relationships and take responsibility for our own hurtful words and actions, which may be sabotaging our ability to connect and forgive others. I have recently begun somatic experiencing therapy to assist my body in letting go of the trauma that it holds. Dr. Dave, your podcasts have significantly inspired my personal journey towards healing, and in an effort to encourage others to do the same, my husband and I feel we must financially support your endeavor. Dr. Dave, as you have been called to provide people with windows into a wide variety of approaches to healing, I believe that those of us who are listening are being called to donate what we can to further the healing of others. Thank you.
Thank you, listener and supporter Kathy O'Canna. Your feedback and financial support have made my day. I hope others of you will take heed and join Kathy and husband Michael in their support. I don't know whether you noticed or not, but my intro to today's guest was a lot shorter than in recent episodes. This was a result of the poll on our site. We ended up with 47 of you listeners casting your votes. 15 voted for the longer bio, 26 voted for the shorter bio intro, and 6 of you reported that you're fine either way. So the shorter intro wins the day. But remember, the full bio will continue to be available on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. I hope this will help to motivate you to visit the page from time to time, even though most of you are listening on a mobile device. And it's not altogether impossible to read the site on your mobile device, although it is more challenging on a really small smartphone screen, like on the iPhone. I'm now posting a new poll on the site, and I would very much appreciate your input. It has to do with the transitional music that I play at various points during the episode. I'm not talking about the Shrink Wrap Radio songs with words, but rather the short snippets that I play between certain segments. What I have been playing for some time now is a very up-tempo transition that sounds like this. Now, my rationale for this choice is that I know I have a pretty relaxed, maybe even laid-back voice delivery. I thought something more dynamic would help to keep you awake and to make the overall experience more dynamic. I did hear from one person, though, who said he prefers my earlier musical transitions. And one was by listener Nir, that's spelled N-I-R, and that transition sounds like this. And in the new poll, I'll refer to it as near horn music. And going even further back, I used to play a snippet of piano music that sounds like this. So, the new poll will ask you to choose between the current up-tempo, the near horn, or piano, or that you don't care. Be sure to cast your vote so that I can make a solid decision. You'll find the poll in a red box in the right-hand sidebar on the site. You have to scroll way down to see it. Also, I need to alert you to the fact that our phone message number has changed. The new number is 206-309-4707. We have a new transcript on the site. It's for number 384, Women and Wine, Her Best Kept Secret with Gabrielle Glazer. Thanks to Gloria Ullman for yet another fine transcription. And remember, if you wish to transcribe a favorite episode, just drop a line to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Well, depending upon how the vote goes, that may be one of the last times you hear that musical transition. I'm running long, so I'll just read one email from our listener community. And it's from Adna, who writes, "Dear Dr. Van Nuys, I write to thank you for contributing so much to my personal understanding of psychology and its practice, and to my education as a future psychotherapist. I began listening to the podcast about a year ago, and I haven't missed an episode since. Yay! And have even gone back to catch up on older episodes. Double yay! I find the shows to be interesting, engaging, and I always learn something new, even when I don't expect the topic to hold my attention. I wonder if you would be interested in doing a show about the different paths to becoming a psychotherapist. I returned to school last year because I want to be a practicing therapist, but I'm so confused about which path to take. MSW, that's Master's in Social Work, PhD, or PsyD. For someone planning to work in clinical practice, Is a PhD better training than a clinical MSW? How many patients care if someone has the PhD letters after their name? What kind of opportunities are denied to one type of clinician versus the other? Is a PhD/PsyD worth the time for someone seeking a second career or for someone who doesn't intend to teach or conduct research? And what is the future of the practice? Is there still a place for humanists, Jungians, analysts? As a 36-year-old who is just now beginning the long road to becoming a practitioner, these are the big questions with which I struggle. After I complete some undergraduate prerequisites, I plan to apply to graduate school, and since I don't know what kind of program I want to pursue, I'm preparing for a PhD and rounding out my experience by working as a volunteer counselor for a crisis line and as a research assistant in a lab at Yale. But I sometimes wonder if a good clinical MSW program wouldn't prepare me just the same for clinical practice. I'm sure that a lot of your listeners are in a similar position to mine, and many of us would be interested in these answers. I would really love to know your opinion about what kind of education and training might produce a well-trained, effective therapist, and maybe the opinion of other educators that you might be able to interview on the topic. Thank you again for your valuable, meaningful work. I look forward to many new episodes and wish you good health and wonderful experiences in 2014. And that's from Adna. Adna, these are excellent questions that you've raised, and of course you're right that at least some other listeners may be struggling with the same issues. On the other hand, I think much of my audience will not be in the same position. So rather than devoting a whole episode to these questions, let me address them from my point of view here and now. If you're really clear that you want to be a therapist, then it really is not necessary to go on to either a PhD or a PsyD. The doctoral degrees are needed only if you figure that there's a possibility that you may want to do university teaching at some point. Doctoral programs are very competitive to get into and also very expensive. So I think that anyone who is certain that what they want to do is psychotherapy and not university teaching is well advised to go for a master's degree. And of course, you could always go on to a PhD later in life if you chose to. And I'm not sure that it matters greatly whether that master's degree is in clinical social work, clinical psychology, or counseling. I know that in the United States, the MSW degree tends to have an advantage in the eastern part of the country, especially for those who are interested in becoming administrators, such as running a mental health clinic. Many social work programs have a strong bias against those who want to go into some form of private practice. These programs tend to be very socially activist-oriented and tend to regard private practice as elitist. So I think that's something you should be aware of and inquire into closely if it's likely to be a concern for you. If you don't end up working in some sort of community mental health setting and decide to go into private practice, you would be well advised to be something of an entrepreneur. And also, it's very helpful to have a specialty if you live in an area where there are lots of other practitioners. It's a fairly competitive environment these days in many parts of the country. I think the volunteer work that you're doing now is really great preparation for whatever program you ultimately aim for. And also remember that your education does not stop with either a master's or a doctoral degree, and that your continuing education in the form of workshops, seminars, and listening to Shrink Wrap Radio will add to your continuing development. I hope this advice helps. And with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on my new message phone number at 206-309-4707. Thanks to Professor Mark B. Ryan for the rich insights into William James. My next episode will feature return guest John B. Arden, and we'll be discussing his new book, The Brain Bible. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind, body, spirit.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.